I've talked with him a little bit about it, and I've talked with Steve, NJCEI, about it as well. And one of the things that I wished I had done while Steve was still up here in New Jersey and not in Florida is take him up on one of his opportunities to tag along for a VHF contest weekend up at Dave's place, or even a work weekend. But do that, because I still think the invitation's open. But you brought up another subject that's pretty cool.
Yeah, Gordon was just talking about Steve N2CEI, who is the president of the group called Down East Microwave, and they make an awful lot of VHF, UHF transverters and other pieces of microwave ham radio equipment. Probably one of our best American manufacturers of equipment, which that company, Down East Microwave, was started by one of the smart guys from the PACRAT, the Mount Airy VHF Society, and Steve N2CEI and his wife bought that business and been carrying it on very well. So it sounds like you and Steve are working together from time to time. Gee, just look at what you're missing, Mel, because you don't have one of these arrays of 16 Yagis, 304 elements on 100 feet of tower there on Dover Street. Just look what you're missing, Mel. Boy, you could put Brooklyn on the map again. K2KUI, K2RIW.
And if your neighbors saw what I put on my 40 by 100 lot, they'd cringe.
Yep. And a good buddy of mine in Phoenix, Arizona, has a piece of property that's, I think it's 45 or 50 feet wide. And on there, he puts an 18-foot dish, and I think it's on the front lawn of the property, and he radiates 200 watts on 10,000 megs and then moonbounds with it. So if you're a real friendly guy and you've got a good relationship with your neighbors, it's amazing what you can get away with. Mel, you might want to go to your mailbag or make comments on all this craziness that Gordon and I have been talking about. K2KEY, K2RIW.
WATCEL.
Andy, recognize. Let Mel say a couple of words and we'll come right back to you, Andy. Mel, go ahead.
Hey, this is K2KEY. I see some comments. As far as filters and all, yeah, they are costly if you're going to buy them, you know, commercially. I have made some. In fact, when repeaters really were in their infancy, basically when they just really began putting repeaters here on 2 meters, a friend of mine wanted to put a repeater in Pennsylvania, and we basically made our own repeater up by just putting, at that time, a Drake TR-22, putting apart the receiver and the transmitter, and I made the cavities with pipe, as you said, made it out of copper pipe, tuned them up for them and everything. Oh, everything was really, you know, lashed together. Worked quite well. You had it up there for quite a number of years. The repeater only ran about 1.5 watts, but with the antenna up at the height that he was able to achieve with it, it gave them what they needed in that area. As far as receivers go, well, I was privy to, you know, a laboratory where we did a number of tests on some of the so-called high-end receivers, transceivers and receivers that are marketed by the big ones. And that was a rude awakening, and I won't go into it because I don't want to start a riot on here, because it was a very rude awakening which receiver really came out as far as a number of the factors that govern the modern receiver. And I wouldn't mention the name, the one that came out, because I will start, like I say, World War III right here on the TechNet, so I'll let it go. But it was really something to behold, really what receivers under really stringent laboratory tests, which you can determine really what a receiver is capable of. And the one that was the most capable would have been the biggest surprise of all to everybody. But for my own 2 eyes. All right, pick up Andy and then we'll go on. This is K2KEY back to TechNet, K2RIW.
Now, when it comes to any doubt on antenna gain, receiver performance, and whatever, you got to make measurements. That's why for lots and lots of years, the East Coast VHF Society set up an antenna range at Trenton College and out on the lawn of the college. They went and made real good measurements with Dr. Dick Turin, W2IMU of Bell Laboratories, the guy who wrote one of the main procedures for doing outdoor antenna range testing in a way that's traceable to the Bureau, so to speak. We were using his suggested technique, which is called the reflective ground plane antenna range test procedure. So when we compared amateur-built antennas to the commercially available antennas throughout those years, very frequently there were some surprises. There were times when a commercial product would claim a particular gain. We actually go and measure it and find discrepancies as much as 10 decibels. The commercial antenna sometimes would tend to be lower than it claimed. Okay, Andy, we talked about you earlier. I mentioned the fact that a guy new to ham radio can buy any old piece of equipment that's been thrown down a flight of stairs. It's got a dented front panel. As long as you can make it work electronically, we'll put the guy on the air. I said that you were able to do that magic, Andy. W-A-2-C-E-L, to defend himself, K-2-R-I-W.
Yeah, right,
W-A-2-C-E-L.
Good evening, I was listening for a little while. And, yeah, it's more sophisticated now than it ever was. I'm not going to be eating it too long because I'm in the middle of getting some emails done for work tomorrow. And, Dick, you and I had a discussion about what's going on. I'll further that with you next time I speak to you on the phone. But there's one thing that you mentioned, and it's interesting because it's dealing with some of the specifications that's going on my work environment, and that is second harmonic levels. And what is the FCC ruling on them? I'm sure you know about it. And also, it pertains to people who want to build their own equipment. You know, I guess if you think about it, way back when amateur radio was new, you really didn't care much about spurious and second harmonics and third harmonics and so on, because who are you going to really interfere with? But in this day and age, with the high tech world we live in, with all these communications that's out there, the FCC, as Mel mentioned, regarding receivers, has become pretty stringent as far as, you know, putting a lid on what's the maximum level of a second harmonic emission that, relative to the fundamental, the mean carrier, you know, is supposed to put out. And looking it up, we've been using this formula, which you're probably familiar with, which is 43 plus 10 times the log of the power level. And that's rated in BBC below the carrier, as far as what the FCC makes a determination. And I'm assuming that radio manufacturers, at least the ones here in the United States, I don't know about the stuff overseas, what's built over there, what their FCC spec is. You know, their spec may be different than ours. And of course, that causes a problem of bringing a radio into the United States, which is legal in one country, but could be illegal in another country. And that's a possibility. I think you would agree with that, up for discussion. But regarding amateur service, so anything on the HF band, their specification is 40 dB below the carrier. It should be anything less than, not greater than, 40 dB below the carrier of a particular transmitter putting out a certain amount of power on the HF band from 1.8 to 30 megs. And hopefully the FCC and the manufacturers are stringent to that because of the either type acceptance or type approval. And that's another question, because I still don't understand the difference between the two, type acceptance, type approval, which should be maintained. So I brought up a number of different issues regarding that, just to mention it to you, because in dealing with the third-order multi-tone harmonics, we have to make sure that they do meet the FCC specification, even for the stuff that we're doing, even though it's low power. Even a handheld, a 5-watt portable, has a certain restriction on second harmonic levels. Of course, it's much lower, but it is defined by the FCC. So, I just thought I'd throw all this out to you, Dick, because it is interesting. WHCDO, back to you.
Yeah, thank you for that, Andy. That formula, which is the FCC law, 43 dB plus 10 times the log of the power, probably in watts. If you're running a 10-watt transmitter, the log of 10 is 1. 1 times 10 is 10, and 10 to the 43, you get 53. So in other words, a 10-watt transmitter should have all harmonics and stereo signals 53 dBc, 53 dB weaker than the signal. A 100-watt signal comes out 63 dB weaker. A 1,000-watt signal is 73 dB weaker. If you calculate what that means, it means that the undesired products are always the same amplitude. You go 10 dB higher in signal, you need 10 dBc more rejection of the harmonic, therefore the actual power level of the harmonic is the same. So let's see now, for a 1-watt signal, it would be 43 dB down. 43 dB down is 1/20,000th of a watt. 1/23,000th of a watt is, I think it's minus 43 dBm, 43 dBw, which is plus 13 dBm, or plus 17 dBm, I think. I'll eventually get the numbers. So in other words, what the FCC is doing with that specification is they're saying that you will not radiate more than X number of milliwatts of undesired frequency power. And so a higher power transmitter has got a tougher spec to meet, but it's still the exact same amount of power of the undesired frequency. And just definitions like that are required. Other than that, in theory, a fly-by-night transmitter manufacturer could be making transmitters to create a lot of television interference, even on a cable TV system, or maybe affecting FAA aircraft and other services, other emergency services. Nowadays, because of the Department of Homeland Security's requirements, I imagine that the FCC is going to be a little bit more diligent when it comes to making sure people meet these specs, because the day will come when Homeland Security wants their equipment to work well. They want more communication equipment. There are communities on Long Island, there probably are some in some other locations, where people have made the mistaken impression that RF energy is dangerous, and they want all antennas removed from their town. And the the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, is saying, oh no, you're not going to do that. And even if you think you're going to do it, we'll simply condemn your property and put those antennas right back. They've done some surveys of the metropolitan area, and the DHS is not completely happy with what they find. They think that our intercommunication between our first responders is nowhere near as good as it should be, and they're going to try to do something about it. So if in your particular community you've got an RF phobia, which by the way has just struck a town in Taiwan, China. Taiwan, China right now has a number of people forcing their government to remove cell phone base stations from many communities, because people have come up with the mistaken idea that cell phone base stations radiate RF energy, which is dangerous to human beings. Absolutely, positively not true. But when you look at the words and you hear the ranting and raving of your neighbors who get fired up with a false alarm along these lines, as some communities on Long Island have done, you can see how this thing can get out of hand, becomes mob rule and a range war and craziness. So modern-day communication system is here to stay. You might as well learn to live with it. If you really feel that strongly, that you've got to get away from all sources of radio frequency energy, radio frequency transmission, radio frequency signaling, you have the freedom in this country to go live with the Amish and the Mennonites. They live a very simple life where they have essentially no electronic appliances, and therefore there's no cell phones in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, among the Amish people. You can live with them and live a very simple life and get away from RF energy if you think that's what you got to do. Other than that, you shouldn't force that opinion on the other people of your particular community, because when a disaster occurs, every bit of communication and then some is going to be needed. That's a strongly felt opinion. You're allowed to express the opposite opinion right now if you want to. KQRIW listening.
Yeah, I think I'm just getting some interference. I just want to mention one more thing, WHCDL was related to us. You hear me okay, right?
We're hearing you fine, Andy. You should just go right ahead.
Yeah, okay, I can't get that noise a little bit. Yeah, you see, the problem is, and I don't know where it stems from, I'm going to use BPL, Broadband Over Power Line, as an example. You're very familiar with that and what's been going on Long Island with the testing that's been occurring. And what is the ruling regarding interference to amateur services, which is a major issue, and we see the video on it. We're in the Carolinas. It was at one of the LIMOC meetings. They showed a mobile HF operator with his ICOM 706 in the car going through a BPL environment and showing the noise level on the S-meter going up to just about maximum level as they traveled through the BPL environment. And then, of course, when they left it, the noise level dropped back down, and this was on most of the HF bands. This is an example of how serious BPL is. I don't know, I have not been keeping up with the latest on that. Maybe you have. What's been going on. But it is a problem because of the interference that it occurs. Did I say that right? Interference, it occurs. Even though it's not related to second or third harmonics and things of that nature. But, you know, it's part of technology, and because it falls back on that. With the advancement of all this communications, you got to be more careful, and that's why the FCC has to be more stringent regarding setting up these rules. And I understand these rules, the latest rulings came out in the late 90s, early 2000s, which I think is in effect until the year 2010 or 2011. So they have to abide, you know, the manufacturers have to abide by that. So I just thought I'd mention the BPL part of it also. Yeah, Dick, I have to leave because I gotta finish up my emails here for the week, but I'll be in touch. And I'll be listening in, WHCDL.
Okay, Andy, thank you for your additional information. It is my belief that broadband over power line is a nice sounding concept on paper, so to speak, if you're a bit naive. It is my belief it's going to die a natural death for economic reasons. People who have discovered the internet just can't get enough bandwidth. I mean, there were days with dial-ups when we used to have 20 kilohertz and then eventually 56 kilohertz of bits per second, 56,000 bits per second with a dial-up system. And now that we all have, many of us have DSL and cable modem and other kinds of systems where we have a million bits per second and 10 million bits and 20 million bits and 50 million bits per second, we all want faster service, more bandwidth. We want to be able to ship down a motion picture live by way of the internet into our home. So broadband over power line, an unshielded service, can't ever come up with anything like those kinds of bandwidth. Therefore, a lot of people in non-rural areas are going to be very unhappy with BPL. On top of that, for BPL to be viable, you need a certain number of amplifiers per mile to re-amplify that signal that's being radiated over those power lines. So it's expensive in the original installation. It's narrowband in service to the individual customers. It's a pipeline that is limited in instantaneous bandwidth. If by BPL at high noon, 50 neighbors on one particular block or one particular section of town all want to talk simultaneously over the internet, they're going to run into a clogged condition. The system can't handle it. So the only person I think that's going to be happy with George being on the power line is the person that lives on a farm that's 20 miles out of town in a rural area where all the farms are 5 miles apart, so to speak, and there is no local cable service to them. It would be too expensive to install the cable down all of those utility poles, and there's too few customers that'll pay for it, so there's no return on investment, so that nobody's going to do it. By way of satellite TV, they still can have pretty good service as far as television watching is concerned, and if they go to the right satellite internet connection service, a little bit more expensive, by satellite they can get reasonably broadband. So for a bunch of reasons, I think VTL is an experiment that we have to keep an eye on to make sure it doesn't get too bad as far as what it's going to be doing for us during the transient, as I call it. Transient meaning that during this testing phase, naive organizations are going to try it, see that, see whether it works for them. In the case of a utility company like Con Ed or LIPA or New Jersey Power and Light, I can see how broadband over power line for their internal communication and for their telemetry might be handy. In other words, if a VPL-like system, once every half hour, reports on the voltage at a particular junction of their power line system by way of VPL, I can see them doing that, and I can see that being reasonable. But to try to satisfy private homes and businesses, customers, at the rate that people want internet connection these days, by way of VPL, I think it's not going to happen. That's an opinion, and you're allowed to express any other opinion if you want to on this subject at this time. KQLIW is the TechNet, and we're listening.
WB2BXL.
Go ahead, WB2BXL.
I recall reading the FCC very cleverly solved the problem of VPL interference with mobile stations. I believe what they did to solve that problem was say that mobile measurements don't count. Am I correct?
Frank, they can't say that. They may have, some individual not properly informed may have said it, but that doesn't mean it's the official word. Because they have their own rules as to microvolts per meter that shouldn't be radiated on certain frequencies. Certainly on FAA frequencies, they're not going to exceed a certain number of microvolts per meter. So on, when it comes to vital communication services, certainly in those areas, they're not going to do it. Now, are they going to relax the rules a little bit for the ham radio frequencies? Maybe. But the microvolts per meter specification, to my knowledge, never said we got one set of readings that are required for private home measurements and another set of readings to be measured from a mobile vehicle doing the measurement. Microvolts per meter is microvolts per meter, as I see it. So, if I make the measurements in my property and they're exceeding it, but then I go out to my automobile in my driveway and make the measurement and they're still exceeding it, but the measurement in my driveway doesn't count, you can see, of course, that's a sugar. It's crazy. Over to you, Frank, K2LIW.
Yeah, it's Meshuggah, but I definitely recall reading somewhere in QST that that's what the FCC was trying to say. And I believe that's one of the arguments in the ARRL's suit they're filing against the FCC, is that the FCC, by saying things like that, try to keep VPL going as the commissioners want to, is not complying with their own rules. So you're exactly right. It's Michigan, and it's inconsistent with the FCC's own rules, but that's what I recall reading some FCC officials are trying to say in order to, you know, to save this thing for the commissioners who think they'll eventually make money on this when they go back to the private sector.
I'm pretty sure this is all going to shake out, Frank. I think it's an interesting experiment. Things are being learned in the process, but I'm led to believe that the majority of communities will not accept this technique. I don't think it's economically viable, and even if it does work, it's only going to work for a very short period of time. Because as I see it, we all are demanding more bandwidth. no matter how many megabits per second my computer is able to deliver to me, I wish it could be 10 times higher. It's very similar to a guy who buys a sailboat. If he brings his friends on a sailboat, he wishes the sailboat was bigger. Assuming he can afford it. I wish my car was bigger, and so on. Wish my house was bigger. Wish my tower was bigger. But you're always going to be wishing for more bandwidth. And as it is right now, we have almost all discovered Google and a few other search engines, and we just can't live without it. I'm about to throw out many pounds of paper of catalogs that I used to keep. It's now available on the internet, so why should I book my house with all this fire, non-resistant paper? So I'm about to throw out a lot of stuff. I have no choice. A modern person does that. I've been a pack rat up till now, and I'm going to have to lighten my pack ratism. Some of my friends are offering to me very attractive pieces of hardware. In some cases, I can't accept it because my house is full. That's crazy. I got to unfill my house. I don't think BPO has a great deal to offer. I don't think it brings a lot to the party, so to speak, and I think it's going to die a natural death. Now, it is my belief that the FCC officials want to give it a fair trial. They know that everything in the beginning has growing pains, and there are glitches, and so they're willing to gloss over some of those glitches in the beginning just to give it a real fair trial. Hopefully that somebody will find some kind of a breakthrough. Well, the only real breakthrough is going to be a whole lot of band reject filters for all of the ham bands, for all of the cell phone bands, for all of the FAA frequencies, for all the police and fire frequencies. And by the time you add all of those reject filters on each one of the amplifiers in the system down the line, the system gets expensive, and the overall usable bandwidth goes down. Therefore, the bit error rate, or the communicating rate goes down, and the bit error rate goes up. And customers are not going to tolerate that. I mean, very few people will tolerate dial-up at 56 kilobits per second these days, if you're lucky, is what a dial-up can give you. Very few people will tolerate that anymore. I bet there's less than 1% of the population that's on the Internet. That's an opinion. And if you have any further opinions, give me your call at KQRIW and the TechNet.
KQRIW, KQRIW.
I think it was W2CTT. You could use a little bit more audio. Correct me on your call letter, sir. Give us your name, and then proceed with your question or comment. My name is Dick.
Okay, Dick, I know the push-to-talk is a little bit noisy. WB2CQT, Larry. Do you think money under the table to the officials that make these decisions might have any effect on it? Over.
Interesting question to ask, Larry. And even if it does, it's only going to be temporary. Because the service itself doesn't have enough to offer. Everything to be viable has to have a certain risk-benefit ratio. Good side, bad side. Good news, bad news. And we've already expressed a moderate amount of bad news on BPO. Not a great deal of good news, except for a person in a very rural area that has nothing else and refuses to go to satellite communication. And those are rare individuals. So even if temporarily there is funniness going on at the time that you've got the kind you're talking about, Larry, I can't believe that that alone will make it persist. That's my belief, my understanding of human nature. Maybe I'm a bit naive. But I don't think you can keep paying people off for a long period of time to take something that is not economically viable and keep shoring it up. Whoever is doing that paying is eventually going to run out of money if the thing itself is not self-supporting. It is my belief that BPO is not self-supporting in the big picture, in most communities. I think we're doing a bunch of experiments and a number of somewhat naive utility companies would like to find another source of revenue, and they'd like to think that this is it. Well, let's wait and see. I'm doubtful. Anybody with any further opinions, give me your call letters, KQRIW. Hey, we may have actually closed down that particular subject, Mel. And Mel is looking into his mailbag right now for those really juicy questions. He's going to come up with one. KQKEY, KQRIW.
Somebody run to VUU.
Stand by a minute, Mel. WN2VUU, I think it is. Correct me on your call letters. Give me your name and your question or comment, sir.
Yeah, has nothing to do with the subject at hand. How are you doing? This is Frank. Foxtrot Romeo Alpha Nova Maquila, Long Island here. Question about SWR. Are you ready for this?
Oh, it's one of our favorite subjects, Frank.
Okay, I was waiting for you to get on the air for about 2 weeks. I had a problem with the radio. On tune-up, on HF, one of the National 500. One of the old ones. All tweaked up, all done, all fixed, right now. Fix the power supply. Ta-da. We're using for a tuner, the H2 Museum. When I tune up, look at the SWR on forward power, we put it on set. And we put it on reverse, it's hot. And I kept changing diodes, doing this, doing that, checking the tuner around, fixing the antenna, making it higher, making it longer, new feed line, for about 3 weeks, until I pulled some more hair out of my head. So a little while ago, I said, well, the tuner must be lying. The diodes must be bad again. Well, it can't be. You put three sets of exact diodes. Make a long story short, not the diode frequency. On forward power, he resides. It tunes up well on most of the bands. On reverse, still it's hot. Comes down to TED, a little teeny bit. Thinking, well, the SWR must be that high. Chance of getting the signal out. So we go to RF power, and it shows it's putting out 110, 120 watts. What's going on? So I finally stuck another SWR meter in one, closer, let's say, to the antenna, out of the tuner, into another SWR meter, and back into the antenna. And it shows a pretty good SWR. Well, my question to you is, you must have heard this before, and it's been in all the ARRL publications, and on the net, and I've seen this 1,000 times, and my question is, what's going on? Should I believe the tuner's meter, which doesn't seem to be reading right, or the little meter that I have on the side, opposite of the tuner? Which one is telling the truth?
Yeah, there's a way you can confirm this one now. As I see it, Frank, and that is to use a known good dummy load. A known good dummy load at your frequency, in theory, has an extremely low standing wave ratio. And when you're using that, all the metering should agree. All the metering that's within near direct contact to the dummy load. I will admit, though, if you put a SWR bridge or a bird watt meter or whatever on the input end of a antenna tuner, while the output is on a dummy load, there are ways you can adjust the antenna tuner to read a high viswire. So you can have a high viswire of the antenna, you can have a high viswire of the antenna tuner. Those are independent, depending on how you set the dials on the antenna tuner. So when you're looking at the antenna tuner viswire indicator, you have to ask yourself, is it on the output side or the input side? Usually it's on the input side. On some brand names, you can flip a switch and make it go from output to input side of the tuner. That's the first thing to know about. Second of all, when it comes to the failure of a standing wave ratio bridge, there's a number of ways it itself can fail, even if it's got good diodes. Good diodes are necessary but not sufficient. A good standing wave ratio bridge really is a kind of directional watt meter, somewhat like a bird watt meter, except you don't have the slug, you can flip back and forth. You could say it's a bird watt meter with two individual slugs, a slug that's tuned in the forward direction and a slug that's tuned in the reverse direction. In order for that reverse direction slug to work correctly, it must have a property called directivity. In other words, when you set it in the reverse mode, when you flip the dial, your rotary dial, and you're looking at reverse power, it should measure reverse power independent of forward power. Those are two completely separate kinds of power. One of the hard things to believe about a transmission line, and at first this is very hard to believe, the signal that flows from left to right on your transmission line is thoroughly independent from the signal that flows from right to left, even though they came from the exact same transmitter at this instant of time. The transmission line itself keeps those two signals flowing independently. And in order to prove that to yourself, you can assume that a pebble dropped into a puddle of water is a kind of a radial transmission line. Drop a pebble into the north end of the pool, and you'll watch a wave travel to the south. Drop a pebble into the south end of the pool, you'll watch a wave travel to the north. Drop a pebble into the north and the south end of the pool simultaneously, and you will watch those waves flow through each other with essentially no interaction if the waves are small enough so it's acting linear, no white caps. So, transmission line system. Keep the signals completely separate. In order for that property to be withheld inside of your standing wave ratio indicator, it must have this property called directivity. In the reverse mode, it must be non-responsive to a forward signal. Well, you can create a signal which has nothing but forward and no reverse by using a good dummy load. So by putting the dummy load in the right place at the right time and setting the controls correctly, you should be able to figure out what's going on. And there is the possibility that the built-in terminating resistor that should be inside of your directional indicator, which is called standing wave ratio bridge or forward and reverse power indicator, it has to have the right kind of internal coupling, the right kind of a dummy load resistor, in order to have this property of directivity. So now you're going to have to do a little bit of extra digging there, as I see it, Frank, to find out whether or not your system still has directivity. And you've gone the first step by using another measuring machine. That plus dummy load properly used should be able to tell you eventually what's going on. You'll have to go step by step and say, hey, what does this all mean? I think it's W2VUU, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, you ironed out a problem. I knew I was in a right direction, but with your technicalities, I absorbed most of what you said, and I've got a good grip, if you will, on what you said. Okay. We tried every possibility there was. I mean, I've been around a while myself, and this one really threw me. I know if you keep putting SWR meters in, each one might read a little different. So just use one SWR meter of a good quality. And I said, voila. Well, we are getting a one-to-one looking antenna, and it is, as you said, probably in the tuner itself. Because no matter what we did to the little PC board, putting new diodes, so on and so forth, still did the same thing. Just want to know if it's lying to me. Okay, now we have a starting point, and now we found an ending point, and I thank you for the comeback. You unraveled a mystery to me. This is the first time I ran into this, and I ran into a lot of strange stuff over the years and was able to track it down and correct it, but this one was a real hero puller. I thank you, Dick, for the comeback, John. It's Whiskey November 2, Victor United. United, Foxtrot, Romeo, Alpha, November, Kilo, in your TechNet. That's very interesting listening to. It's been a while since I heard about this. So I'll let you pick it up with the rest of the guys and see what other conversations you're going to have out there, and I'm going to listen out. And I thank you again.
Yeah, good luck with that project, Frank. You now know a little bit more what you're looking for. Did the terminating resistor on the printed circuit board get damaged or disconnected? In order for the directional coupler section on that printed circuit board to work correctly, it's got to have the right distance between the straight two line and the coupled line. It's got to have the resistor in the right spot. Maybe see some gimmick tuning capacitors that got to be working correctly. It may be emphasized for a particular brand name of diodes. Maybe a different brand name of diode with a different capacitance is in there. When it comes to a directional coupler, a directional indicating system, there's a lot of ways it can go wrong. Everything's got to be just right in order for it to have this property called directivity. And directivity is a kind of a quality factor. A good directional coupler will have 15 to 20 dB of directivity. An excellent directional coupler will have 30 dB of directivity. I own a directional coupler that has instrument grade, which is called 50 decibels of directivity and above. In other words, the signal flowing in the wrong direction, the coupler will only respond to it 100,000th ratio smaller than ideal. That's close enough to ideal for me. So there are couplers and there are couplers. And if you care, there are ways you can tweak yours up at your favorite frequency and make it near perfect. That's another whole area of study of ham radio and electronics in general. And when it comes to using bird watt meters in the transmission line, when you have a moderate amount of reflectivity out of the antenna, boy, you can get some crazy readings. You can have a transmitter that you know produces exactly 50 watts. And connect it into a real antenna that's giving you 10 watts of reflected, and you may think you're seeing 57 watts forward. And you'll say, what in the world's going on? The transmitter can't make 57. Well, that transmission line may be really seeing 57, and that bird could be telling you the truth. You'd be amazed how many people will tell you, oh, the bird's lying to me. Not necessarily. There are other people who will say, this forward and reflective power, that's only reactive power, it's not real. Well, I can take that reverse power that you think is reactive and not real, and I can light a light bulb with it. To me, that's as real as it gets. So, this whole subject of standing wave ratio is very misunderstood in a lot of areas. We all have to dig a little bit deeper to find out where the truth lies. And the number of people on, we'll say, 20 meters on a Saturday afternoon that will tell you that you should adjust the length of your transmission line until you find that magic length, a quarter number, an odd number of quarter wavelengths, an even number of half wavelengths, where the standing wave ratio disappears. They really believe that. It's absolutely not true. Your poor directivity standing wave ratio bridge may show that to you, but it may be lying to you if it doesn't have high directivity. There is no magic length of transmission line that will make standing wave ratio, if it exists, disappear. A certain amount of power is being reflected. If that transmission line is working correctly, regardless of its length, it's going to bring it all the way back to that transmitter. And the transmitter might be unhappy about that. And there's no magic length of line that's going to stop that from happening. But the point is, lots of guys will tell you there is. And it's an unconfirmed old wives' tale, in my opinion. Okay. Mel, we've only interrupted you twice. Want to try again? K2KEY, K2LAW.
Okay, this is K2KEY, yeah. I've checked the number of SWR bridges that are sold, you know, popular ones, and checking them against my bird watt meter, and it was a rude awakening for a lot of people. In fact, if you take these run-of-the-mill SWR bridges and you turn them around, in other words, so that the in is the out is the in, and compare the readings, you should be getting basically the same readings in reverse. In other words, the forward is the reverse, the reverse is the forward now. And it shows you many of them are so far off that it's just a relative indication, not to make gospel. Again, the one or two of them that were pretty good was one of the best, I found. SWR bridge, other than using the bird watt meter, which I own a couple of, is this one inline unit called the MicroMatch. I wonder if you've ever heard of this, Dick, over.
I own a number of Jones MicroMatch devices, and for the most part, they're beautiful. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, Roger. They're the ones, I own a number of them also. They're the ones that I use. A remote reading meter, and find that this could be closer to accuracy because I could actually adjust them inside to coincide with my laboratory standard. All right, very good. And let me see, what else? Let me see. I'm trying to look up here to see what the heck we've got here. Again, about antennas here, vertical antenna. Is in a vertical antenna, you said last week something that the radiation resistance is a function of the height wavelength. Well, according to what I was talking about, basically, we were discussing that amongst other things about the dipole, the center-fed dipole, being in a vertical laid out, using it in a vertical. And basically, what I meant to say at the time, or maybe we misunderstood us, that a centerfed type dipole that I was using in the vertical is actually what I was doing. Is actually you're taking two verticals. You want to look at it. You're taking two vertical antennas and putting them in series. So in other words, the dipole overall length in wavelength has twice what we said was twice the radiation resistance of a vertical whose height is one half of the wavelength. In other words, basically what you're looking at is with this vertical dipole type of configuration. You're looking at two verticals actually standing one on top of each other, and we're actually just feeding it, because basically this is what it is. The dipole is just two verticals in this case. When it's just vertically, when I pump it vertically, that's the way you can look at it, just two verticals in series, basically. All right, that's basically, I don't know why that's in confusion, but I think that's about the easiest explanation on it. Over.
WB2HW, NFED.
Well, it can be NFED, and it still be centerfed from the end. But I'm gonna reword exactly what you said, Mel. A ordinary quarter wave ground plane antenna, which some people call a vertical, quarter wave vertical. But a ground plane antenna has a certain characteristic by way of the counterpoise or ground plane. It's creating a mirror image, and the other half of the dipole appears to be there at this half. So making a total of a half wave, even though your real radiator is only a quarter wave. A real half-wave dipole could be called a pair of ground plane antennas back-to-back. Call them in series, if you like. I call it back-to-back. And once you've got the pair of them back-to-back, you don't need the counterpoise anymore. You don't need the ground plane radials. Now, once you've decided to make a vertical half-wave dipole, which is a pair of quarter-wave ground planes back-to-back, you can feed it multiple ways. You can feed it in the true center and bring the feed line off at right angles. Mechanically, a little bit difficult, but you can do that, and I think it's basically what you did, Mel. You can also create a bazooka, either a skeleton bazooka or a real bazooka, a real sleeve, as they call it. In other words, the bottom half of this half-wave dipole, the bottom quarter wave, could be made into a sleeve, either by a real piece of tubing or a skeleton piece of tubing, by having two or three lines coming down in parallel with the transmission line. And with proper sizing of the thing, you are electronically feeding the vertical dipole from the center. That's where your transmission line goes to feed it. But the transmission line really goes down the center of the radiating section of the dipole down at the bottom. But you've made it fatter in order to do that. And you have to juggle the length a little bit. If you Google the word sleeve dipole or bazooka-fed dipole, you'll find a number of designs that do this. Common sense would lead you to believe that the upper half and the lower half of this vertical half-wave dipole would be identical in length. You can do it that way, and it'll work. You can make it work a little bit better if you disturb the length. Make the sleeve section on the bottom a little bit shorter. Make the dipole section on the top a little bit longer. I think I have that direction right. And when you do it correctly, you end up creating a kind of a sleeve balance where there is very little or no RF energy flowing down the outside of the transmission line as it comes away from the antenna. So you can feed it that way. Or if you're willing to use a impedance step-up device, you can literally feed the outer end of a half-wavelength long dipole, which is shorted in the center. The output impedance, load impedance of that, when you feed it from one end, is a couple of thousand ohms, and that could scare you if you didn't have the right kind of a loading network, an impedance step-up network built in that area. If you study the inside of every mag-mount 5/8 wave antenna, they've done the exact same thing. There's a loading coil in the bottom, which steps up the impedance. Electronically, you could say you've made a 5/8 wave into a 3/4 wavelength length electronically even though mechanically it's a 5 wavelength long. And 3/4 wavelength is again resonant in the antenna itself. And there's all kinds of other ways you can make it a little bit longer and a little bit shorter than that and put the right kind of impedance matching network in the bottom. So once you've decided that there's a lot of advantage of a pure half-wave vertical dipole, you've got at least 3 ways of feeding it. Each has its advantages and disadvantages. It's a matter of how much resources you're willing to put into studying the problem and which approach mechanically solves your problem or pleases you the most. I've been doing some experimenting on the sleeve fed. In other words, the end fed half-wave dipole, the transmission line goes up one end but really feeds the center of the dipole by way of the bottom quarter wavelength long sleeve. And so a J-pole antenna does a little bit of that, except that it's an open structure that's doing it. Howie, I know you wanted to add some questions to comment to this. You got it, Howie. KQIW in the TechNet.
All right, Dick. You know, when I was back on CB and a ham radio back when I was like 10 or 11 years old, 12 years old, I did 2 3-foot whip and put them. Did not know. I used lip. When I was younger, meters and on 10 meters, on 15, on you in those days, trip the center conductor out, take the center conductor out, take the shield and put the shield back on the cable and would hang it for the country. The hot end, you know, the one end of the cable, the hot end, and tie it to a string and just let the cable hang down with the shield. Pulled back over itself. Worked very well, Dick.
Yeah, some people call that a sleeve fed or a bazooka fed dipole, where you take the braid and fold it back down for the for a quarter wave approximately, and the center conductor plus leaving the dielectric on it if you want to, is the other quarter wave up, and that can work quite well once you adjust the lens correctly. So that is a sleeve fed half-wave dipole, collinear fed, I would call it. You're really feeding the center of the dipole, even though the transmission line is going up one end. So there's only 3 ways of doing this, and each has its advantages. So, and now, that whole structure, once you've decided the right way to feed it, in the case of a vertically polarized dipole where you raise the whole thing higher and lower above the ground on vertical, I think the rate at which the impedance of the dipole will change is fairly slow until you get to the point where the bottom end of it is almost touching the ground. But other than that, it's rather slow in the way it changes impedance because it tends to have a null in the performance directly off the end of the dipole. Well, directly off the lower end of the dipole is the dirt. You've got a null out of the dipole pattern in the direction of the dirt. So it has very little rate of change of impedance versus altitude. That's another advantage of a pure vertical dipole. And it's the one antenna that doesn't require a zillion ground plane radials. You can have a phase center that's nice and high above the ground. You can have the lowest radiation angle to the horizon you're ever going to get. And if you're a long-range DX fan, I'm amazed that that antenna isn't a hell of a lot more popular. Mechanically, it's a little bit more difficult to put it up. You need a high support like a tree or a tower or whatever to do it. In the case of an 80-meter half-wave vertical dipole, you wish you had a tree that's 135 foot tall or a tower that's 135 foot tall if you're not using shortening techniques. And not many of us have got that, but it does separate the men from the boys. But on 40 meters and down, I think it's relatively easy with average height of trees and good towers that we can lay our hands on. That's an opinion. KQKEY, KQRIW.
Let me make another comment, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead now, Howie.
I used to have a lot of fun on 6 meters with those antennas.
I believe you.
You copy me?
Sure do. And I bet you on 6 meters, you got out very well with a pure vertical antenna, didn't you?
Oh, up in the country, when the band opened up in May and June and July, you talk a lot of DX. I ran an HA460, 20 watts. Had a little HA460, hung out on 50.2, 50.3. It worked a lot of DX along with the Craig Venus. I had the HA460 because I didn't lug up the whole station. Just took an HA460 and had a lot of fun. But you know what else I did, Dick? On 15 and 20, I used to take ham sticks or mobile antennas and put them back to back, they can make loaded dipoles. Go ahead.
Very crafty. And you realize that electronically, it can have one length regardless of its physical length. And as long as you're smart enough to do a little impedance matching if required, you'd be amazed almost anything called antenna can be made to work. As long as it doesn't have carbon granules or buried into its design, or it's not made out of nichrome wire, every watt you put into an antenna will be radiated somewhere in the space. And the pattern by which it's radiated in the space is not that difficult to find out. It's not that magic. There are modeling programs. There are pages of the antenna handbook or the antenna manual from ARL that for all reasonable lengths and altitudes will show you what kind of pattern you're going to get, nicely graphically displayed. So the data is there if you care enough. And so I think all of us have got to start saying some more pleasant words about a pure vertical half-wave dipole. That poor antenna has not been given anywhere near the emphasis it deserves. The high-performance antenna that used to scare us, well, we're not that easy to scare anymore. It's about time we find out what's really going on. KQKEY, K2RAW.
Okay, good, K2KEY. Yes, it does work quite well. I've used this vertical, well, not pure vertical dipole. As I said, it's landed 66 degrees with the ground. For some reason, like I tested, whether it's a particular location or whatever, it does work excellent. And it surely is a lot simpler than my 80-meter vertical, which has a heck of a lot of radio put down, an awful lot of radio. But for the low-band DXing, I wasn't going to, try to, I can't reduplicate, of course, any kind of a radio situation for 40 meters as I did for 80 meters. So I am very satisfied with this so-called 40-meter vertical dipole. And I have worked a lot of the DX stations on there that I was surprised to work because the propagation wasn't that great. All right, so that's the story on that. Shall we go on, Mr. Dicknadel, or you've had it up over?
Yes, let me make a comment to Mel.
Go ahead.
You know, Mel, when I used to be on 40 and then also on 6 and 10, I have found out that when I had the antenna sloping, I made slopers and changed the angle. It all depends. Sometimes it works very well. I just think it's the time of the day and the ionization, you know, how the signal's bouncing. And also, I have an antenna on 10 meters that I'm using called a Kreckman. You can take a look at it on our website. It's up at the receiver site. 10 meters antenna. It's all one piece. The antenna's ground mount, you know, it's grounded. The whole antenna is grounded. And it has a loop inside, so it has like a little loop. Coax has a loop, and it's basically magnetically coupled to the outside. That's like a dipole. And I'll tell you, it works very well, Dick. K2RIWWD2HWW.
I believe that almost any of these antennas properly installed, as long as they're not made out of the bad stuff, nichrome wire or carbon granules, they got to fly once you treat them properly. Mr. Schneider, time for you to take over. My, we're getting very formal tonight.
Okay, the beep returned at 11 o'clock. All right, very good. It depends on what you're going to do on 80 meters, 75 meters. Of course, I've got the loop, but that's the local, more or less, focus, my friend, which is, the radius a few hundred miles. But if you want to do low-banding DX, that's another story. I have bounced back and forth between the different antennas and everything, switching AV back and forth. And this seems to be about the best of all worlds. The sloping of the dipole, vertical dipole, definitely, Howie, it seems to work better. It's not time of day and all. I've done this experiment. I guess maybe you didn't hear what I was doing with raising and lowering it and changing it from the plumb position back to different angles and then pulling it up to the horizontal position. I went through a whole rigmarole, spent a lot of hours playing back and forth, and I found that this is the best of all worlds. Okay, shall we try the next one, Dick?
Fire when ready, sir. K2LIW.
Okay,